had a lot of discussion as to when we're going to have the meeting, much less the substance of the bill. So, Senator Lyatz, why don't you give us a sense of the bill? I will tell members that there have been a couple of requests for testimony that we'll take. And we have an amendment, the 838 amendment, which I think has been distributed. We have, actually, we have four amendments, I think, which have been distributed. This bill, I should point out, was heard in the Judiciary Committee. Is that correct?
That's correct. Lyatz?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And then it was heard in Senator Betzold's State Department's division. No action was taken. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it was tabled because of the fiscal bill, so there is no division before.
Okay. And so this has been scheduled in the full committee. I'll have a couple of comments. Let's just hear a little bit about the bill, and I'll have a couple of comments about where we are relative to the fiscal note. The 838 amendment does potentially impact the fiscal note. So, Senator Lyatz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would first like to thank my co-authors on the bill, Senators Cohen, Clark, Moi, and Scheid. This bill has been around the legislature for a number of years. In fact, it passed the Senate floor in 2004. In none of the years that it has come before the legislature has there been a fiscal note attached to it until this year. So that has required us to come through the Finance Committee route. I am pleased to announce to you that there has been an agreement on policy language with the governor's office. So if we pass the bill in its amended form, with the amendments that are prepared before you, then we have an agreement with the governor's office, I understand, for the bill to be accepted. Of course, we have to deal with the fiscal aspect of the bill. The bill is called the False Claims Act because its purpose is to recover taxpayer dollars, which are in essence stolen from the government because of false claims submitted by usually a company, a business that is doing business with the government. The typical example is in the Medicaid fraud arena, where a company, such as a large pharmaceutical company, or in a Minnesota example, a company named Walgreens, that is submitting false billings to the state for the purpose of, and knowingly doing so for the purpose of getting more money paid on those bills than they are entitled to under the contracts that they have with the Medicaid system. There's been a federal False Claims Act in effect since about the time of the Civil War when President Lincoln proposed it in order to get after contractors that were taking advantage of the federal government with war expenses. There is currently a federal False Claims Act which covers the Medicaid fraud arena, but there is an area that's uncovered. The state does not have a specific statute that does this. 22 other states do. The federal government has in law a bonus of 20% over what we currently get in the state for our share of Medicaid recoveries just by the very fact of the state having a False Claims Act enacted into law. In addition, what the experience of other states has been is that until there's a state False Claims Act, it is much less likely that whistleblowers will come forward to expose this fraud. The theory behind the False Claims Act is that a whistleblower will come forward in response to a financial incentive to do so. Their financial incentive is a share of the recovery. So if, for example, $1,000 is recovered and they get 15% of that $1,000 as a reward, as compensation for them coming forward and exposing the fraud. I'll give you an example, and it's not a False Claims Act case, but the importance of an insider coming forward. You all know about the Tom Petters Ponzi scheme. No law enforcement agency, the federal government, the state government, no one was aware of it going on until one of Tom Petter's top associates went to the FBI or the U.S. Attorney's Office and told them it was happening. We simply don't have the resources in all of our investigative agencies to examine every complex medical billing that comes through the system. So that's the purpose of the bill. Texas found that it worked very well. They didn't have any whistleblowers coming forward between the let's see here. They had the QI-TAM position. They passed the False Claims Act in 1995, but there was no whistleblower financial incentive until 1997. There were no lawsuits in that two-year period, but after the QI-TAM provisions were added, relators began to file cases in Texas. Since their first act was unsealed in the year 2000, they've recovered more than $360 million for federal and state of Texas taxpayers. So it is a very effective incentive to expose this kind of fraud, and that's the purpose of the law. Some of the materials that you should have before you will give you some information on this. Texas spent about $12 million in fiscal year 08-09 to increase the recovery efforts, but in 08 alone, they recovered over three times that amount, not including the money that goes to the federal government or the whistleblowers. So you might view this as a compliance issue to recover the stolen taxpayer dollars. Now, I would anticipate that you'd have the same level of success in Minnesota. I do have the whistleblower from the Walgreens case here, Neil Thompson, if you'd like to hear a little more in detail what happened in that case. But I could tell you in short, he basically gave up his career as a pharmacist when he blew the whistle on Walgreens. No one would hire him as a pharmacist after that. He was fired, of course, from his job. And that's one of the reasons why you need these extraordinary financial incentives to get a whistleblower to come forward. They are making a life-changing decision when they do that, and they at least need a cushion to encourage that to happen and to give them the ability to make that life change. There have been a number of concerns that have been raised specifically about the language in the False Claims Act. One of the concerns that has been raised is the potential for False Claims Act lawsuits. In particular, the worry is that a company might be liable for mere inadvertence or mistake. I will tell you that in response to the ongoing expression of these concerns, the authors in the House and the Senate have made a number of changes to the bill. One is we deleted a provision that would have created liability for finding out about an inadvertent billing error and knowingly not correcting it. There's no liability for that. We have added a specific provision in the bill which states that there is no liability for inadvertence or mistake. The standard of liability in the bill always has been that the actor knowingly submitted false billings to the government. So even without the other protections, that standard of liability alone protected against liability for inadvertence or mistake. We also have, as an amendment that I will ask you to adopt, a restatement of the agency principles that apply in False Claims Act claims taken out of federal case law that would make it crystal clear that an employer is not liable for an act committed by a non-managerial employee that violates this section unless the employer had knowledge of the act, ratified it, or was reckless in the hiring or supervision. That's standard black-letter case law on agency principles. So once again, a low-level employee or clerk doing billing could not bind the entire corporation with liability. That would be the A29 amendment. We also have proposed to comply with the agreement with the governor's office, the amendment A40, that would even more specifically exempt mere negligence, inadvertence, or mistake, saying it cannot be deemed to create a knowing act, and also delaying the effective date until July 1, 2010, instead of July 1, 2009. There is also an amendment, A27, that would put the bill in the shape that resulted from my extensive discussions with the Minnesota Attorney General's office relating to state government activity. Any claims by or against local governments would be handled by local governments only, and the Attorney General's office would not be responsible for handling those. I would welcome the opportunity to answer your questions, and I think we have done everything that we can to put this bill in a shape that would effectively provide incentives to recover taxpayer dollars, fraud that we know is going on out there but we just haven't uncovered yet, but would also balance the concerns of those who are nervous about the bill.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, you mentioned that the governor's office was all right with this. Who told you that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, as we left the Senate floor, I received an email from Representative Simon, who is the chief House author and who has been directly speaking with the governor's office, and he informed me that they had an agreement on the policy language with the governor's office, and he sent me the language to reflect that agreement, which I forwarded to Mr. Watson, who has incorporated it into the A40 amendment.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman, who normally would you deal with in the governor's office?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, Representative Simon has been dealing directly with the governor's office. I have not. I could not answer that question for you in this particular case. When the time is appropriate, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to address the issue relating to the fiscal note.
Okay, I think what I'd like to do, members, is we have several people who would like to testify, so let me take the testimony, and then we'll consider amendments and have further committee and debate. I think that might be the best way to proceed. So in order, the people I have who requested an opportunity to testify, Mr. Thompson. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Neil Thompson, and along with myself and my partner Dan Burance, we were the relators that blew the whistle on Walgreens in the case that was settled last fall. I want to correct Ron just initially. I wasn't terminated by Walgreens. I actually still am on leave with Walgreens. I left simply because of the pressure that management was bringing to bear. But since then, I've applied to five different positions in the pharmacy business, and I don't know if you know anything about the pharmacy field right now, but there's full employment in the pharmacy field. There's demand for pharmacists. All pharmacists graduate from school, have jobs waiting for them, $10,000, $20,000 signing bonuses. I've placed five different applications and not even gotten a call back. So I've essentially been blacklisted in the industry. But even people that stay within the companies, really, they're essentially stymied in their professions. Being a whistleblower is employment and financial suicide, because you'll never get another raise, you'll never get another promotion. You'll never be considered for Employee of the Month, that's certainly for sure. But essentially your career is done when you've done a whistleblower action like I have. But it takes people like myself to identify this type of fraud. The fraud that was going on in the Walgreens company probably couldn't be identified by anybody in the government. In fact, they don't even have the proper information transmitted to them to be able to identify the false claims without having somebody on the inside. Even if they applied an investigator to it, they still would not see the proper information transmitted to them to be able to identify it. So it takes a person on the inside to be able to identify these false claims. I want to address a couple other points that I've heard in other committees, and I've not had a chance to really respond to them. One of them is that people state that this is just a simple coding problem, or it's something that's an inadvertent coding problem. That's exactly what we heard when we confronted Walgreens. In fact, I confronted 5 different managers in the company and told them about their coding problem or their inadvertence of problem. Well, you add that fact to the fact that they didn't train people properly. They didn't address these things with employees. And yes, these were small little coding problems. Some of them were 10 cents. But you multiply that hundreds of thousands of times, and next thing you know, the state taxpayers in the state of Minnesota were defrauded by over $2.8 million just for that one company. So that these are big cases. They're not, even though they're small little numbers, you look at these things and they don't jump out at you. Somebody on the inside recognizes them and sees them. And the only way they're ever going to come forward is if they're protected and if they're rewarded or compensated, because these are career-ending decisions for people. There's also been talk about what's called a cure provision in these statutes. And we should have some sort of way for companies to be able to bring this forward and people get out of it easily and solve these problems as a cure provision. Haven't we had that for the last 20 years? Haven't people been able to come forward and tell their bosses that this has happened? It's always been there. But the problem is, how is it working out? It doesn't happen. I'll bet you the Attorney General's office doesn't have people flocking into their offices to turn in their employers. I don't have statistics on it, but I'll bet you the number is close to zero. Because people won't do it unless there is compensation and protection for these people. We have to be practical about this. No one's going to turn in their boss unless there's the protection. Now, there's protection in the Medicare and the Medicaid field. We have a federal law. And I don't know why the healthcare industry is even worried about this, because the federal law already impacts them. The only thing that the federal law does when we have a state law is to enhance the reimbursement that we're going to get. We're going to get an extra 20%. It doesn't change the playing field for how we deal with Medicare or Medicaid. And in fact, Medicare and Medicaid frauds don't even impact the finances of this state. They're all investigated by the federal government. We don't have to worry about increasing our budget for compensating, increasing the Attorney General's office, because they don't handle Medicaid fraud. The federal government does. The Department of Justice. So take that out of the mix, because that doesn't even apply. Also, the Department of the Attorney General says that they have to have a certain amount of money to be able to investigate and review these fraud cases. They don't have to review any of them if they don't want. It's made. It's just permissive if they wish to. They can pass all of these cases. They can decline to review any of these cases. They don't have to increase their budget to be able to investigate them. They can decline them all and turn them all back over to the private attorneys. They've done it in the past. A classic example is the tobacco litigation. They didn't handle that case. They turned it over to a private firm that did an excellent job and now puts millions of dollars into the state budget for that. They're doing it now. One of the largest drug cases that they've had in their office is being litigated by a Boston law firm sued out in the state of New York. So they have experience in taking these cases, sending them out, and having private law firms do them. quite frankly, I think a physical note is disingenuous. They don't need this kind of money to be able to investigate these cases. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Have any questions for Mr. Thompson? We've also had a request from Brian.
I'll ask Mr. Thompson to address all
okay.
the issues. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We also had a request from Carla Heil from the Attorney General's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil, and I'm mainly here to answer questions, and we appreciate all the effort that Senator Latz and Senate Counsel have put in listening to the Attorney General's concerns regarding this specific language, and that's in the A27 amendment, and we do appreciate that. We do have an ongoing concern about the funding, and in particular, one issue that we have where we differ with some of the testimony is that under the federal guidelines, in order for the state to get the 10% extra from the federal government, under federal regulations, it says that there will be review by the Attorney General. And we believe that where the federal guidelines say with review by the state Attorney General, that our office would in fact be expected to review every False Claims Act that is filed. And that's specifically why there is a 60-day under seal provision. And certainly we understand that other states have the may or shall language, but still the federal guidelines say with review by the Attorney General. In the concerns with the fiscal note in particular and the A38 amendment that we just saw, part of the cost of the fiscal note is the cost if the Attorney General is primarily responsible, which if they get involved under this statute and under the federal guidelines under the Medicaid provision, the state Attorney General has to take responsibility. And in order to prosecute these claims, there are large consulting fees, and that is part of the reason for this office's fiscal note.
Ms. Heil, let me ask. Since you've had the opportunity to review the A30 amendment, Mr. Mossman and I have had some discussion relative to what would be the appropriate amount in the establishment of this special revenue account. The fiscal note calls for a little over $2 million, I think, $2.055. Would you suggest that's the appropriate figure if it's set as a special revenue account, or would you look for something less than that?
Mr. Chairman, it obviously is in your discretion. And specifically, there's two reasons. The startup cost, where before you get any money back, it can be in litigation for a couple of years. And also, it is our understanding, even if this is not retroactive, that a lot of the claims that are in other states will still be filed in Minnesota. And we have talked to 20 to 30 states, the 20 states who have False Claims Act, that is what has happened in a lot of those states where they have immediately received a lot of False Claims Act where they review them.
Okay, so what figure would you look for in the A38 amendment setting up the special revenue?
Your Honor, Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm not able to say specifically the amount. But do I believe that $1 million would be sufficient? I do not believe that.
Further questions for Ms. Heil? Senator Vetzel.
Just to be clear, Ms. Heil, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the, one of the amendments was dated April 2nd, which was, I believe, after the budget division approved the bill. I'm just looking at it for the first time. But if you've had a chance to look at the amendments, do you know whether or not they would
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, the A27 amendment is the language that the Attorney General's office does support, where it has added political subdivisions representing themselves, and it also corrects the language where the state cannot sue the state, so that should limit the cost for the state of Minnesota in defending. And also, with some of the other specific language, it does allow specifically the Attorney General to recoup the attorney fees and the consultant costs, which was unclear in the first engrossment. And our fiscal note initially did relate to that, to the A27 provision.
Sir Betzel.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Heil, so your fiscal note assumed the A27 amendment?
Correct.
Okay. One of the amendments would delay the effective date. What effect did that have on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, if the effective date is delayed, that would impact the fiscal note, that it would be less.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Heil, well, I mean, it strikes me that delaying it just, I mean, because of the fiscal note shows our $2 million cost every year, if you delay it, I would assume that would still mean the $2 million cost every year just starting later.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
The amount would be the same, but the implementation would be delayed.
Further questions from Ms. Heil? Okay, thank you very much. Then to conclude testimony, there has been a request from representatives from several groups would ask that they maybe just all testify at once, not speaking at the same time, but maybe just go to the witness table and offer a couple of minutes for care providers, the Hospital Association, and Aging Services Minnesota. And who wants to start out? Mr. Feinwax, or you look like you're sitting down first, so.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Feinwax. I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. And while I speak for hospitals, I would also note that the people who have expressed great concern about this bill are, of course, Minnesota's nursing homes, physicians, chiropractic physicians, and others. And it is an array of healthcare providers. We are not shoplifters. We are not thieves. We are not Tom Petter. We are the people who provide you with medical care. And this issue is, to a very large extent, about coding. But before I get into that, let me say, as clearly as I can, this is unnecessary. We have a federal law that does this. The federal law works fine. The whistleblower that you've heard from recovered under the federal law. All the people here who want this have recovered and done handsomely under the federal law. We don't believe a state law is necessary because it's unwarranted, it's expensive, and it will cause us financial harm in that it creates new forums, new definitions, new ambiguities. It will increase insurance costs for the cost of defense because of litigation. The Attorney General's office has placed a fiscal note on this, and we believe that fiscal note, if anything, is understated. This is going to be an expensive proposition for Minnesota for no real purpose other than a handful of people who practice in this area want it done. We are grievously concerned that there is going to be a flood of these kinds of claims. In other states where these laws have been passed, the majority of states do not have such a law, but where it's happened, there has been a backlog of approximately 190 to 200 cases, which then immediately hit the dockets and have to be reviewed. There is an expense associated with this. The other interesting item is what I'm going to refer to as a payday loan phenomenon. If you do this, our Department of Human Services, as soon as these claims come forward, basically have to make refunds to the federal government whether or not the claims are pursued. So you will find that this can actually cost you money in terms of the fact that you are fronting money to on the basis of potential frivolous litigation, no matter how frivolous, and no matter whether or not anything ever comes of it. I have here copies, which I would propose to distribute to the members, if that's all right, from the Attorney General of the State of Washington, dealing with this, and I ask that you consider this correspondence for two reasons. Number one, it clearly indicates we're not the only ones who hold this view, and in fact, this view is a realistic view. And I'm going to direct your attention to the last paragraph, which says, in sum, while a False Claims Act, and this is a State False Claims Act, would seem to be a good concept on its face, a review of the specifics of how the settlement is apportioned as compared to its costs makes it clear that the proposed act not only may not benefit the state, but may result in a net loss. And in fact, we believe that that is true here. There are serious fiscal implications. Having said that, in these turbulent times, with people being displaced from health insurance coverage, with MinnesotaCare, with our rates being cut, and perhaps most importantly, with the federal law itself changing to incorporate a lot of this, this seems to be the worst possible time for this worst possible of all ideas. The other issue that I wish to direct to your attention is that in many respects, this is perhaps the most unneeded thing that we could think of at this point in our time. We have serious problems, and $2 million is a great deal of money. You know, divide that by how many nurses won't be laid off, how many school teachers, you know, pick whatever divisor suits you, and you will see that that this is this is inherently a bad idea. So just so you know, what we have proposed and the amendments which are surfacing don't really do any good. The amendments tinker around the edges with existing defenses. What we have proposed, because no one favors fraud. When I tell you it's about coding, our experience has been with computers, with numbers. We're talking about billings that are generated in the hundreds of thousands in terms of volume. We're talking about codes that can be off by a digit. These are wrong. These can be construed as false. We want to know about them. We want to make them good. What we've suggested is a novel and radical concept that says, why don't you come to a person of our choosing, not your choosing? In other words, we have compliance officers. We will designate a list of people, or the law can designate a list of people. If you believe a billing is false, if you believe the state is being cheated, you come to somebody on this list and you tell them, not the buildings and grounds supervisor, not the cafeteria manager, you come to these people. You tell them you think something's wrong. If they look at it and they decide something's wrong, they're going to make a refund, the state gets its money back, the mistake is undone, everybody's happy. If they tell you, we're not interested, we think you're nuts, then you proceed with the other remedies available under the law, litigation, what have you, no problem. This is a simple, straightforward mechanism to assure that the state recovers funds and errors are brought to somebody's attention without the need for litigation, without expensive discovery, and without disturbing insurance premiums and the other kinds of negative consequences. But for some reason, nobody wants this except the people who are adversely impacted by this, and we think that this would be an elegant solution to whatever problem might exist. But this has been roundly suggested by the proponents. So what I would ask you to do is to vote against this measure, because this is just a bad idea at the worst possible time.
Mr. Feinwalk, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Senator Bergman?
Chairman, I just have a question about the letter that was handed out. It says that the federal government bill would not meet the criteria to earn an additional 10% return of federal share. Is that our bill is talking about, this letter is talking about?
Mr. Feinwalk?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I'm not absolutely sure on that point. I don't think anybody understands it well enough to answer that. I will say this, that the projections I've heard in terms of what the so-called federal SPIF would be make it about a tenth of what the AG is going to spend sorting these things out and chasing them. So whether it does or not, we're going to have a net loss here.
Thank you. And I know which of you wants to go next.
I'll go next, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota, and one of two people speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I will also have a handout here that I'd like to have distributed as well.
Ms. Thurlow, before you forget, I'd like to remind you this is a finance committee, so zero in on the task before us, which is the financial aspects of this.
I will do my best, Mr. Chair. I want to point out that the handout that if we could have distributed also lists some of the other organizations that have raised concerns about this particular bill, that it's not just hospitals and nursing homes, but it is a variety of interests included, and you can see that they are listed there. I would pick up on perhaps the best place to start is perhaps with the question that Senator Berglund asked first and pick up on that. And I want to make clear that there is no guarantee that the federal government would even approve this for the federal SPIF until it is seen by the Office of Inspector General. They do not give us any prospective advice on this. So there is no automatic guarantee of anything under this bill. Contrast that with the risk that, in addition to the hospitals, the older adult service providers are very concerned about the extra cost that this will impose on nursing homes and other older adult service providers. And for that reason, we also remain very concerned and encourage the no vote. I think that the financial impact of this bill on the state is unknown. But what is known is that this will have a negative could potentially have a negative impact on financial stability of older adult service providers. I would also call your attention to one provision in the H-27 amendment that would allow, for example, prospective plaintiffs to conduct investigations and discovery before a civil action is even undertaken. That would mean that in the case of older adult service providers, potential plaintiffs could go on fishing expeditions that are costly for us, where we don't have money to begin with. We don't have huge legal trust fund or legal funds to even defend against this. And before a civil action can even be undertaken, proposals like that in the A27 amendment will have us to incur costs before we even defend ourselves. Even in cases of the knowingly standard, there are issues that will have to be litigated. And in the case of complex billing, where ultimately we may prevail, those cases are expensive, and there are fact patterns that need to be adjudicated. And quite frankly, the financial incentives on the behalf of the whistleblowers are very high. As the proponents have explained already, there is a federal law that allows proponents to whistleblowers to go forward and bring forth potential claims of abuse. But this particular state cause of action brings it to a whole new level, a whole new area of risk for nursing homes and older adult service providers, and causes us great concern. With that, I'll turn over to my colleague as well.
Are there questions for Ms. Thurlow? I don't see any, so go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pearson.
Go ahead. Working with the long-term care imperative. There are two things that I'd like to echo that have already been stated, just to put a finer point on it. First, we do support the need to weed out fraud. Nobody here is saying we're in favor of fraud. The second point is, this will do, and as the previous testifiers have said, the potential unintended consequences of passing this bill are huge to nursing homes. For example, if a facility buys a software product, nursing homes are going through, in 2010, they'll be going through a third version, MDS 3.0. If a facility buys a software product where that product has something miscoded, and then the facility starts using the product over and over and over, the facility, because the definition says no proof of specific intent to defraud is required, could be on the hook for every single one of those misclassified codes. So what we've asked for, as Mr. Feinwalk stated, is a bright line test that allows somebody internally to go and report so that we can correct it, and then, if it's not corrected, they can go out and bring their suit. Again, the two points are, we do support weeding out fraud. We think that this bill overreaches in its scope and will have unintended consequences to less. Thank you.
Mr. Pearson, you said you had a second point. The first point was everybody's against fraud. What was point two? You didn't continue with that.
The second point was the unintended consequences of passing an overbroad legislation like this.
Questions for Mr. Pearson? Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, does the 8.9 amendment satisfy the first point?
And Mr. Pearson, have you seen the 8.9 amendment?
Oh. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, may I, if I can start by addressing that point, I don't believe that it does. In part, if I can continue to look at that. The issue here is that it still creates a triable issue of fact in for the first part, that by exempting from liability where the employer has, it basically doesn't exempt us from anything that isn't currently in the law. It doesn't really give us first, as Mr. Feinwax has described, the incentive for the whistleblower to come to us first in cases where there's a problem, to have us fix it first. There really is no right to cure in this particular language, and really doesn't give, at least speaking for the imperative, does not give us the comfort that we're seeking. So, and Mr. Feinwax probably can address in addition to that.
Mr. Feinwax?
Chair, members, I agree completely. The problem with this is it still leaves you in a courtroom debating the meaning of these terms, whether or not these fact patterns existed. It really provides no comfort at all other than saying, well, all of these things can be explored and debated, which we knew before, before we started this. So what we're looking for is a certain mechanism to say, if you think there's a mistake, we're going to clean it up and give you back the money. No muss, no fuss, no cost to anybody.
Further questions from the committee? I don't see any, so I thank the three of you for your concise testimony on this issue. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask Mr. Mosman where we're getting the money for this bill.
Mr. Mosman, where are you hiding the money?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not sure where you're getting the money. The only resources remaining in the Senate position at this point, as far as the budget bills that the Senate has passed, would be essentially from some savings that were freed up, some savings that we started tracking when Senate File 2 was adopted by this committee and then by the full Senate, which related to some elimination of deputy and assistant commissioner positions. That's the only resources that the Senate essentially has in its budget position at this point. It's for general fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, are we passing bills out of finance now if we don't have any money paid?
Well, let me suggest a couple of things. First of all, we've had this discussion on the fiscal note. We've had testimony on the fiscal note. I think a lot of us have been aware of the discussion relative to the fiscal note. There's some divergence of opinion. Just personally, I've been convinced by the Attorney General's office, if not to the dollar, that I think it's appropriate that the fiscal note, if we look at the A38 amendment, this would be a decision for the committee, not just simply my decision unilaterally, that if you look at the A38 amendment, which has a blank appropriation, that we should put a dollar figure in there that's, if not at the fiscal note, we have something close to that. Second, I know there's an amendment that delays the effective date. I'm not sure that makes any difference in terms of the fiscal note. Three, there's money. Senator Metzen had a bill that cost $100 million, and Senator Berglund, you were concerned about that bill as well. And we've gotten a little bit loose with, and we've had this happen before with, not so much out of this committee, but out of the tax committee. And I don't know why, when I served my first term in the Senate, I was on the tax committee, I didn't stay there, because I didn't realize that they just kind of invent money in that committee in very effective ways. And so arguably, you could make that argument. You know, as I walked back in the room, I know Mr. Mosman was talking about Senate File 2. The other thing that comes into play, though, and something I want to make clear to members, and this interplays with Senator Betzold's State Department's conference committee, which is supposed to finish this afternoon. Well, it's 5:30, so probably not this afternoon, but this evening is my understanding. Whatever we do in this committee, we don't have any impact on Senator Betzold's conference committee. The Senate Finance Committee cannot add money to a conference committee. It cannot reestablish a target for a finance committee. It cannot say, conference committee, do whatever. If a bill passes, whether this bill or another bill, and a conference committee within their target says, okay, we now have $2 million for this particular purpose, that's a decision of the conference committee. Now, Senator Lyatz, we can take positive action on your bill if this committee so chooses. But your argument with the conference committee still remains the same, because this committee has no authority to reestablish a target for a conference committee that's a creation of the House and the Senate. The Senate Finance Committee is just a creation of the Senate. A conference committee is created by both bodies. And when targets are established, targets are maintained. Senator Berglund, in your conference committee, I'm sure you would have been delighted if the Senate Finance Committee had said, well, we had this money from the Tax Committee, and we've set this money set aside. Here's $50 million. And you might have liked that, I bet. You might have even accepted $100 million, for that matter. And that didn't happen. And in the same way, we can't impact, at a smaller level, Senator Betzel's conference committee. I'm kind of look around the table to see whether their chairman, Senator Vickerman, I think you're still doing a little bit of work, aren't you?
They have something to pay for
there,
too.
Yeah, yeah. So Senator Anderson's done, Senator Tomasoni, Senator Higgins are finished. But the Finance Committee can't instruct a conference committee. So if that makes sense to everybody, Senator Betzel, I don't know if that, I won't put you on the spot, but I don't know if that Senator Betzel.
Yeah, for those who don't know, and you probably should, the House has adopted the False Claims Act into the House bill, not with the amendments that we may be looking at here, but they have it in there. They've also booked, I think, about $300,000 for it because they don't recognize, they ignore the fiscal note, basically. And some of the arguments that Senator Lass has made are the ones that I've been hearing in the conference committee saying it's permissive, but the fact of the matter is, as recently as last Saturday morning, I asked the Attorney General's office if they still stood by the fiscal note as we have it here, and they said yes. I explained to the conference committee in the House, I said that we would be meeting today in the Senate Finance Committee, and I would get a better sense of what the Senate's position was based upon that. And it's my understanding that the Senate Finance Committee does say we still recognize the fiscal note. Now, if we delay the effective date, that doesn't make the numbers go away, it just pushes them back a little bit. But so my position going back to the conference committee is that the Senate Finance Committee does recognize the fiscal note for what it is, and we will hold to those numbers, and that if the House is determined to press ahead with this as part of the final conference committee report, obviously we may have some different language to proceed with it, but they have to fund it out of my targets and not from anything else.
Okay. And certainly, let me just make one other comment. I don't mean to be just disingenuous about this, but this is the first I've been made aware that the House, in their bill, has $300,000 in their conference committee.
What they did, Mr. Chair, is they've got two different bills. They've got a reform bill, which actually Senator Rest has, and this one here. And I've asked them if they could separate the False Claims Act from the Department of Finance reforms, and they said that they were not able to do that. But the best that I can figure out is that they booked no money for the one, and they booked $300,000 for the other. But they won't even tell me how they're breaking up those numbers.
Well, the comment I was going to make was, far be it from me to tell Senator Betzel what he should do or not do within his conference committee, but hypothetically, if Senator Betzel was to say, Senate took a position that this bill or any other bill, well, this bill is funded by X number of dollars, and became convinced of the correctness of the House position insofar as the money is concerned, if they actually have money in the bill, the conference committee can do what it wants in that respect. If Senator Betzold says, well, Senate position is that this costs $10 million and I don't want you $300,000, again, we can't instruct Senator Betzold what to do. So that becomes a decision, again, within the conference committee. Senator Berglund.
So, Chairman, my understanding is that there's someone here from the Department of Human Services, and the fiscal note that we have is not complete in regard to their portion of it. I'd like to have them come to tell us.
Okay, that's fine. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, members, the House version of this bill, Representative Simon is on the State Government Finance Conference Committee, and he has told me that they have $600,000 to $700,000 of real money from the House side to be applied toward this. So, for the committee's information, that's what I'm being told from my House author. I'm not in on the conversations in the conference committee, so I can't speak to what information was communicated there.
I'm sorry, sir.
I have a number of points, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
With regard to the fiscal note, I don't understand how the Attorney General's office that proposed this over years, Attorney General Hatch proposed it a number of times, it's been carried by several different Senate authors, never once was there a fiscal note. The Attorney General's office said they needed additional resources in order to pursue these fraudulently obtained dollars. Until this year, all of a sudden, it materializes. I think it raises some real questions about its accuracy and its legitimacy. And I think it's fair to ask those questions. Wouldn't we expect the Attorney General's office to be pursuing these kinds of claims? Now, it is permissive in the bill. I don't think that is going to be a problem with the federal government because there are other states that have the same language, and they've been approved for their bonus money from the federal government. But what permissive means is that the Attorney General's office can continue to do what they're doing now with regard to these kind of cases. They either rely on the federal government and the federal attorneys that are pursuing the Medicaid fraud cases to do the investigation and pursue the litigation, or they rely on private attorneys that are representing the whistleblowers to incur the expenses and pursue those investigations on behalf of the private plaintiffs. Or they farm it out to a private law firm, like the Attorney General's office did in the Zyprexa case, where they've got the Boston law firm that is representing the Minnesota Attorney General's office, doing the work for them, and sued it out in New York. Now, that's against Eli Lilly, and that's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars once that case gets settled. Now, we're past the retroactivity discussion, so we're not going to be able to share in that because this law, if we did it, wouldn't take effect. We wouldn't get any benefit from the State False Claims Act anyway. We'd still get the Medicaid fraud, Federal False Claims Act portion, because this effective date wouldn't even be until after that conduct occurred. And in fact, if the effective date is pushed out to 2010, what will happen? No one's going to file a claim on July 2, 2010, because they'll have one day's accrual of damages over which to sue. That'll never happen. So you won't even see a claim filed involving the Minnesota False Claims Act until probably a year later, because you need the accrual of damages to make it worth it for anyone to even blow the whistle and to take the case. Now, it is permissive. The Attorney General's office can simply, and I'll give them the cost of the postage of the letter to the district court judge that says, we decline to intervene in this case. And they can do that. They have every right to do that. State agencies make decisions based on resources all the time about what they're going to pursue and what they're not going to pursue. I spent 5.5 years at the Attorney General's office. I know that we made decisions in our division over what we were going to do and what we weren't going to do based on whether we had the attorneys available to do it. That was just part of what you do as a state agency. So there's no compulsion or inevitability about the Attorney General's office having to do any investigation or pursue anything. If we gave them theoretically $600,000, they could allocate those resources, hire as many people as they can for those $600,000, or save the money for some investigative resources, and do what they can. And what they can't do, they can continue to let the federal attorneys or private lawyers or other private law firms handle on behalf of the state of Minnesota. So that goes to the question of the fiscal note. That's why I think there really is a legitimate question about whether it's accurate in terms of numbers. Now, I want to come back to the other main complaint that you heard from the previous testifiers, which is just let them cure the defect. That would be like saying if you get caught stealing from Kmart and you're in the parking lot and they catch you with the goods on you, you can just say, here, take it back and we'll call it a day. You don't need to arrest me or charge me with theft or anything like that. I gave it back. I got caught. I gave it back. End of story. You can't do that. If the standard of liability is you are knowingly submitting false bills to the government and someone catches you from the government or someone inside turns you over to the government, are you therefore not liable? That doesn't make any sense. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card. So a pure right to cure, which the hospitals, long-term care folks are asking for, is exactly that. Now, what I don't understand is they are all subject to the Federal False Claims Act right now, as we sit here today. They have all of the exact same liability exposure as if we passed the State False Claims Act. The difference is this State False Claims Act will give an additional statutory incentive for the whistleblowers to come forward and to expose the fraud, in addition to the bonus that we would get from the federal government. House Research drafted the bill very carefully after researching other states and whether they were researching the cases, statutes in which the federal government declined to certify them as in compliance with the federal law, and ones where they certified them in compliance with the federal law. So I am quite confident that in all material aspects that the law, the bill that's drafted before you will qualify for the federal provision. And yes, no proof of intent is required, as one of the testifiers stated. But you still have to conduct the activity knowingly, before there is any liability. And that's repeated in the liability section. There are two provisions that state that inadvertence or neglect or negligence even do not create liability. So also on that Washington study, it turns out, I'm informed by an attorney who practices in this field, that their own Department of Human Services criticized that study. It was done by one employee, and it was not given credibility. So to sum up, there is no new liability threat here. When it comes down to, are you going to spend money to try to recover? This is, I think, best viewed as a compliance activity. This is happening out there. We just don't know where it's happening. And the only way it's going to be found out is with a financial incentive. And if the state doesn't want to go ahead and do these investigations, fine. Let the Attorney General's office say, we decline, we don't have the resources. Let the private attorneys that are willing to risk their time and their own resources to conduct the investigation pursue it on behalf of the people of Minnesota. It won't cost the people of Minnesota anything, but it will do is bring in taxpayer dollars that have been stolen. When it hasn't happened, then the liability can't be established and the cases go away. And we, in fact, put one other provision in there at the request of some of those who were concerned about the bill. It provided for attorney's fees to be awarded against a plaintiff that brings the case substantially for the purpose of harassment. So if it's because they want to get even with someone or want to anger an organization or something like that, substantially doesn't even necessarily mean 50%. It could be 20%. And they risk having attorney's fees awarded against them. So there's a belt and a suspenders and a crane in this bill to protect against inadvertence and mistake and negligence, but at least give the opportunity for it to happen. Now, with regard to procedurally, Mr. Chairman, and I know that the conference committee is at work on this and that this is an issue before the conference committee, but as I understand it, there were two thresholds, two concerns that needed to be addressed in order for the conference committee to even consider this. One, obviously, is where does the money come from? And I'm prepared to let the conference committee sort that out. I don't think $1 million or $2 million is necessary, but in the bill that we have before you, $1 million is projected to come in from the federal government bonus recovery, and an additional portion could be allocated by the conference committee in whatever amount they decide is appropriate. But the second piece is we don't have a Senate position on this bill yet because it's been a lengthy process to get to this hearing today. And understandably, conference committees are reluctant to accept provisions in the other body's bill without a Senate position. I can't get a Senate position unless I get a floor vote, and I'm successful on the floor vote. So as I understand the way that the conference this finance committee has worked in the past is if we've passed bills off the floor that contain budgetary money, that is enough to satisfy the Senate's budget requirements to move forward and to be in balance. And if it's the will of this committee in support of the bill, then I could ask the full Senate for a vote. If I can be successful there, then that's at least one criteria that would need to be met in order for the conference committee to consider taking this bill up. And then if they can find the money, great. If they can't find the money, well, that's what we're dealing with this year.
Okay. Sure. We have about a half hour or less to go before we have to be back in session. But Senator Berglund? Yes. Request for testimony from... Yeah. Ms. Corinth? Yes, from Human Services.
This only thing records. I'm Vicki Quinerth. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm director of the section that does investigate provider abuse and fraud, the surveillance unit. And I'm mainly here to answer questions about our specific fiscal note. But currently, we get requests, about 50 or so cases each year from the fraud control unit that they're considering for review, because we have a data warehouse with about 8 to 10 years of claims data, and we do analysis to look at the patterns of not only the specific provider they're considering a case about, but that whole category of providers, and we do the analysis for them. And then as a result of these cases, we return, it varies each year, anywhere from 2 to 8 million for the state share back to the general fund from these cases. So the basis of our fiscal note in this bill is that we assume there will be considerable more cases that the Attorney General will review and therefore we will have to do the analysis for. So we ask for one analyst position.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note that I have I reviewed had no, I don't think this fiscal note, it says preliminary, I don't think it's complete in regards to the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chairman, and members, I am having copied the worksheet from the Department of Human Services, which shows their net costs of about $60,000 a year for the one position. But you're right, of course, that it was preliminary, and the Department of Human Services information was not yet entered in this preliminary fiscal note. A second fiscal note has been requested, and that one was less complete as of the meeting time, so up for all the agencies, not for the Department of Human Services. So I was trying to get the most information as possible in front of the committee, but the worksheet is being copied to show the Department of Human Services numbers.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, State Department's going to fund that?
I can't answer that.
Mr. Chairman, I can respond to that if I want.
Certainly. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, one of the amendments that you have available there is a special revenue fund that would serve as a litigation support fund. And it would provide for money coming in from recoveries to go into that fund to help cover the Attorney General's costs of pursuing this litigation. And I've talked with Mr. Mossman and some others about this already, and I would be perfectly happy if the additional costs, if any, attributable to the Department of Human Services were reimbursed out of that fund as well.
Several.
You have the same issue as the Attorney General's office, that you need this position before there are any recoveries?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund. At this point, it is so hard to tell what the workload would be. Currently, the Attorney General's from the Fraud Control Unit, their demand on our staff time is takes about a third to a half of a staff already, and so it's very hard to predict. So I think we could wait to see what the demand is could be. We are just concerned that it'll be at least another full-time equivalent staff time eventually once this ramps up.
Senator Metzen, did you?
Oh, I just wanted to repeat what I say about every other day in here. Is a couple hours ago, we asked the AG's department to do something, and they need 5 more people. Now we ask them to do something, and they need 9 more people. And what department? I know people are working hard, they're busy, but something like this is pretty important stuff. Can't they find, and Lance, you don't have to say it because you worked there for 5.5 years, but every time a request comes in, we have to add 7 more people, or 9, or 12, or 15. It's not just the AGs. How many assistant attorney generals are there? I don't know, 200, I don't know the number. Could they find a person or two to help out here without too many more? Probably not. Okay.
Well,
it gets old. I just every time, whatever department, Senator Berglund, it's always, and are these people working hard 8 hours a day and can't find a little, maybe they are.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzen, the bill that we're going to vote on later today cuts the Department of Human Services $4 million.
All right, let's forget your department. Let's go ahead and AG.
Okay, the point's been made.
The Congress.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lance.
One other point was if DHS is projecting that they're going to get more investigative requests, and the Attorney General is projecting that they're going to have all of this additional, these additional cases they'll have to investigate, doesn't that tell you something? It tells you that they think this fraud is going on out there, and that this kind of a law is going to generate the whistleblowers coming forward, and they're going to have to investigate it. Well, don't we want them to be able to do that, to bring that money back to the government?
Okay, again, I know.
I've done that.
Senator Day.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the reason the AG office never had a fiscal note in the past is because the bill never got this far before.
Mr. Chairman, it passed in 2004 off the Senate floor.
Okay, Senator Foley.
The fiscal note, we just went through that this morning, and I don't understand why this morning we could do pretty anything we want as far as acting without the fiscal note. Now we're looking at it again from a different standpoint, and we don't need that. So when are we going to fall in and take care of this?
Well, Senator Foley, let me respond to that. This has been an unusual debate in that Senator Berglund has been talking all session, not just session, but the last couple of sessions, about her inability to put a bill together because of the lack of fiscal notes. We have a fiscal note process where, in almost every instance, we accept what comes from the agency. There have been some over the years, I'm aware of some exceptions. This one does become an exception. So it's going to be the decision for this committee as to what number would be appropriate to utilize if we assume we adopt the A38 amendment. That's where we have a blank appropriation. It's going to be up to this committee to decide what number to put in that figure, separate from how it's going to get paid. Is it $100? Is it $2 million? Is it $10 million? Generally, we have not had debates about fiscal notes in terms of the amount. Senator Berglund's problem has been a little bit different in that she can't get the fiscal notes from the agency.
Oh, I also have the other problem that we get them in the
meantime. Yeah, and that's been, I think, unique to Human Services, given some of the complexity of the forecasting and so on. generally in this committee, though, when we've had bills that have either come from divisions or, as in this instance, there was not a division recommendation, we usually have a pretty good idea of where we are with the fiscal notes. So we're going to have to make a decision on this bill and make it soon as to what we want to do with the fiscal note. So, having
Chairman,
Senator Betzold.
Just so the committee is also aware, as part of the budget from the AG's office, we are going into 5% cut, which was translates to like $2.4 million a biennium out of their budget. So as far as absorbing resources, we're cutting the budget as well, too.
Sir Day.
Mr. Chairman, what was the fiscal note in 2004?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, there was no fiscal note in 2004. Attorney General Hatch's office apparently decided they could absorb the resources without asking for a fiscal note. It was their office's initiative with no fiscal note.
I should ask a few other questions for Ms. Corinth, so you don't just sit up there all afternoon. Further questions relative to the human service part of this? Okay, thank you. All right. To the committee, we now have to take some action on the bill, some action on the amendments. Senator Latz, I'm going to start with you as to what action you'd like us to take on amendments in front of us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would welcome someone moving the 827 amendment.
We have four amendments, so I'm going to ask you just to remind us, without getting into a long discussion.
Mr. Chairman, the 827 amendment is a long amendment that basically says if the claim is against the state of Minnesota or involves money from the state of Minnesota, then the state attorney general's office is the responsible attorney's agency for responding. If it's a local political subdivision of the state, then those cases get handled by the political subdivision's attorneys. And that was negotiated together with the attorney general's office. They support this.
Senator Foley has moved the amendment. Is there discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, the A29 amendment codifies the agency principle of liability for the manner in which a low-level employee can or cannot create liability on part of the overall corporation.
So moved.
All right, Senator Wieger moves the A29 amendment. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, the A40 amendment adds one more provision in which negligence, inadvertence, or mistake cannot be deemed to cause liability for the corporation, and it moves the effective date out 1 year to July 1, 2010.
So moved.
Okay. And obviously that effective date may or may not change the amount of money appropriated for the bill. On Senator Wieger's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, I heard the Attorney General's office say the effective date change, at least for the first year from 09 to 10, would affect the fiscal note from that standpoint. So I'd ask you to factor that in. The A38 amendment provides for a special revenue fund that would and also specifies the distribution of recoveries made under the law. Essentially, it does two things. It provides for a placement in that special revenue fund the federal bonus money, which is projected to be received on Medicaid fraud cases to provide ongoing litigation support funds for the Attorney General's office. And I would be perfectly comfortable if the committee deemed it appropriate to include reimbursement to DHS if they had to add a position, although they indicated they could wait and see if they really had the additional work involved. And then it also provides a fund for direct appropriation as seed money, essentially, to get the ball rolling on this this litigation process.
And Senator Latz, since this amendment before we take action is the one that appropriates money, do you have a recommendation for what amount you would put into line 120 in the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the amendment could set up the legal structure whether or not there's an appropriation. But if, yes, my recommendation would be to put $600,000 into line 20. And I say that because my view, and the information I've received anyway, is that that amount of real money is, at least in the House position, on the state government finance bill. And my view also is that the Attorney General's office would not have to access much, if any, of that money until the second year of the biennium, given the effective date change. And third, that it would give them the ability to at least respond initially to some claims that they received, to decide if they wanted to prioritize investigations, and if their investigations they felt that they could not handle with their existing resources, they could defer those investigations to federal attorneys or to private attorneys, or they could farm it out to a private law firm to represent the Attorney General's office. But it would give them something to start working with, and they can do as much as they can with it.
Okay. Just a couple comments. The language of the amendment is that this is a one-time appropriation. Second, Senator Latz, you made the comment about, and I'm paraphrasing what I think I heard. you're recommending $600,000 is needed. You're not, I think you indicated you would want anything or whatever. Let me make it clear. The bill certainly doesn't pass out of this committee unless we agree on an amount. Otherwise, there will be no bill. Whatever happens, wherever it goes. So because we have this divergence in terms of the fiscal note, which is usually not the case, we need to make a threshold decision on that amount before we vote on the 838 amendment. Senator Betzel.
And even if this committee endorses that amount of money, that is not necessarily the direction to the conference committee that we accept that that's the amount of money it takes annually to fund the bill, because that's not the position we're going to take.
And Senator Betzel, as I indicated earlier, it's not a position for this committee to tell a freestanding conference committee what you should do or not do. I might have some thoughts, but you know,
but
doesn't.
I'm just making it clear, Mr. Chair.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, and this I guess is a question to our staff. This amendment establishes a special revenue fund in the state treasury, and recovery of federal money is directed to that new account. If we did not establish the account, where would that federal money be deposited in the treasury?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to the general fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is diverting money from the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, actually, we worked, we spent a fair amount of time with the language with regard to if we do carve-outs from what we're essentially assuming our revenue stream might currently be, we don't do that. That would be like doing a carve-out of the income tax revenue stream or something like that when we're uncertain what that revenue stream will be. So what the language here attempts to try and do is to tie the capture of recoveries to recoveries that we will only get because of the law changes in this bill, and that is the additional 10% bump that we would be able to get because we have a False Claims Act in place.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Latz has suggested a figure of $600,000 for his bill. Again, I'd like to have, because we have, again, this difference of opinion, if that's acceptable to the committee, we can plug that number in. If somebody else wants to suggest something else, again, this is a little bit unusual. Senator Betzel?
Well, and I believe the Attorney General's office said that even a million, that was still, I thought the indicated that was still a bit too low, but I think the committee needs to keep the fact that that is a little too low. Okay. I don't know what the AG's office thinks about 600,000, but they did tell us about 1 million. I thought that they said it was too low.
Yeah, we've had the testimony from the Attorney General's office on that. So I don't think we need to repeat that. Does anybody wish to move on line 120? I'm going to ask that we do it in this fashion. We've had a suggestion from Senator Latz, the author, for 600,000. Does anybody wish to move that figure? And I'm sorry, we have not had the amendment moved. We would need somebody to move the A38 amendment to have that in front of us. Okay, Senator Foley moves the A38 amendment. Now, within that amendment, does anybody wish to take any action on what amount to place in the appropriation line? Senator Foley?
I would offer the 600,000 that Senator Latz.
All right, Senator Foley has moved $600,000 on line 120. Does anybody wish to? Senator Roebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to come into this discussion late, but where is this money coming from?
We're printing in the basement.
Yeah. Senator Roebling, two things. For the purposes of this committee, Mr. Mossman indicated earlier we had passed a change in my Senate file 2, which left some limited bottom line money in this committee. That was the Assistant Commissioner Amendment. So the way we've always handled things in the Senate, at least since I've been on this committee since 1991, is that if there is money not used elsewhere, it's available. And just to kind of go over the history of that, and I don't think Mr. Mossman did this, the original Senate File 2 that I had didn't have a fiscal note. And you might recall that Senate File 2 dealt with the budget process, and I wanted to have some work done in terms of information available to the legislature in terms of a look back of 3 years with agency budgets and so on. That's what the Senate File 2 was. Well, there are all sorts of other provisions added. Senator Clark had a provision, and Senator Ress, and I think Senator Ress might have had a provision, and somebody else had a provision. And so the request was made with all these provisions that we needed someone to pay for it. And Mr. Mossman and I talked about it, and we realized we had not resurrected the old standby of assistant commissioners. In the past, assistant commissioners have been carried in state departments and have been booked in state departments and have been used in targets established for Senate state departments over the last several years. That was not true this year. So that's where the bottom line money is coming from. The other thing, but it's an important issue for this bill, is that whatever amount we use, we as a finance committee cannot direct a freestanding conference committee and those conferees to add a bill, subtract a bill, add money, subtract money when a target's been established. And so this still remains Senator Betzold's decision if he feels that, Senator Betzold, I'm not going to speak for yourself, but hypothetically, too little money, too much money, I don't like the idea. We as a finance committee cannot direct that conference committee to take any action or to accept our numbers if they choose not to. So, Sir Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think I heard this speech one other time, so I don't know how if we've spent all that money left in Senate File 2 or not from a couple of different bills that came through. But I do remember that the bill was tabled in State Government Finance because we didn't have any money to fund it. And so, it was a surprise today to see it on the agenda after I knew it was tabled in our committee, and I wasn't sure how it got pulled into here in the first place, but I guess we were a subcommittee of the Finance Committee, but we did not pass it out.
Oh, no, I understand. Senator Betzold has made that clear, and there's no question under the rules of the Senate, the chairman of the committee, let's not look at Senator Bedsole, Senator Berglund sitting closest to me. If I said, gee, Senator Berglund, all those great bills you've tabled are really great ideas, and I think I'm going to hear all of them, I don't care what you say, a finance division still remains, in effect, a subcommittee within the finance committee. Now, that's not the way we operate. And if a chairman of a division takes a position that a bill is not to be heard, I'm not going to hear it. In this particular case, Senator Bedsole made it very clear to me that the bill had been laid over. There was no recommendation from that division, but he said, if you want to hear it, understanding that it can't impact what happens in our conference committee, hear it. I hope I'm not paraphrasing that incorrectly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, when the bill came to the Finance Committee, stayed in the Finance Committee, was always in the Finance Committee. And I made it clear to Senator Coleman that, well, as a chair of this committee, if you wanted to hear it, that's fine. He had to find some way to pay for it because we were not able to do so. And that's what we've been talking about today. And I explained earlier that the bill had been tabled in our budget.
Okay. We have Senator Foley's motion, I believe, to use $600,000.
Mr. Chair, where is it?
Well, as I just indicated, the $600,000, we're looking at this assistant commissioner money, which remains within the Finance Committee because we passed the bill off the floor of the Senate, and that money was not taken into any conference committee. You know, if leadership had said, look, we passed this bill off the Senate, let's direct that $5 million to Senator Berglund's conference committee, that's the end of that money. That did not happen.
Mr. Chair, the reason I bring that up, if you got an extra $600,000, then I could hook up all those debt tolls out there.
And you could.
Well, yeah, I could.
And you could, but again, as I've indicated, this finance committee doesn't have the authority to do that with your conference committee, because once the bills are out of the finance committee, the omnibus finance bills, they're on the floor of the Senate, they go into conference, then those decisions take place at a level other than the finance committee or the tax committee in terms of reworking targets. Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I also think that we don't get to rewrite fiscal models. I don't get to do that. I've got some that I would bet my life on me that there are savings and I can't get fiscal notes showing me. So, you know, we're going to rewrite fiscal notes.
Yes.
And I don't feel very comfortable doing that.
Well, Senator Berglund, I've made it clear this is, there's a unique aspect to this. And that's why I've indicated there's a divergence of opinion relative to this fiscal note, and that's why I very carefully have asked what the committee would like to do. If somebody on the committee wishes to amend the Foley motion to put $600,000 in here to $1 million, $2 million, whatever, that motion would be in order. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was taken by Senator Metzen's comments about how we keep adding people all the time. And I think probably the best way to keep people fully employed is to give them more to do than they can do in the allotted time. Just like legislators, we always have more to do than we can possibly do. So to keep them fully employed, I think we should have more to do than they can do. And so it's interesting that Mike Hatch could run it without extra people, but now we have Attorney General Swanson who needs extra money to do it. And I guess my preference would be to just zero that $600,000 and not vote for this amendment.
We have Senator Bedsole.
Chair, I'm told there's 40 fewer Attorney Generals today than there were 10 years ago.
We have the Foley motion in front of us. Is there any further discussion on that motion, either an amendment to the motion or further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion fails. All right, so we do not. Senator Foley?
Division.
Okay, we have a. This It's when for somebody to ask that. Although the division's been requested, all those in support of Senator Foley's motion for the $600,000 figure signify by raising your hand. Opposed. My hearing was correct. Motion fails. Does anybody wish to make any further motion relative to the appropriation section?
Well, I'll move the number that's using the fiscal note.
Okay, Senator Berglund moves the figure of $2,055,000. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I'm going to ask for a division on that. All those in support of that motion, please raise your hand. Opposed? Motion passes on a vote of 8-6. All right. Further discussion on the A38 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, having adopted a number, might I suggest that given that you delayed in the A20, in the A40 amendment, the effective date of the act until July 1, 2010, if I could suggest on line 20 of the A38 that the it be amended so that the $2,055,000 is appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Finance for fiscal year 2011. After and Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry, that might not be needed. And the question then is the rest of this language here, are you still looking for a repayment and a one-time appropriation of the money?
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand that we would have money in 1 year from this bill to finance it. So making a one-time appropriation would make sense.
Senator Lantz.
Mr. Chairman, you know, the Department of Transportation did their fiscal note portion, and they projected increased revenues in their calculations, and they came up with a positive fiscal note. I don't know why the Department of Human Services doesn't do that in connection with the Medicaid fraud recoveries that would be brought in as a part of this bill. That's a discussion, I suppose, for Senator Berglund and DHS and the Department of Finance. And I don't know why other agencies didn't do that, but the Department of Transportation looked at both sides of the equation and concluded that a passage of this bill would actually have a positive fiscal impact on their agency. $1 million of what I anticipated might be needed by the Attorney General's office was provided for in the bonus money from the federal government, which I think they will start to be able to pay, certainly when the effective date becomes effective. I'm not certain if they'd be able to start paying it as soon as the bill becomes law, even if the effective date is delivered, you know? That's at least $1 million based on the current budget forecast for Medicaid fraud recoveries. That will be $1 million coming in per year on that. So if the desire is to have the Attorney General's fiscal note paid in full, then the number on line 120 need only be $1,055,000. That would cover the upfront, that'd be seed money, and it would plus the $1 million for the second year. So that's my thought on it. you know, I think the AG's office can live within whatever we give them, and they can decline to pursue other stuff, but that's judgment of this committee.
Well, the committee's voted for the $2 million figure. Does somebody wish to rework that? Mr. Watson.
Mr. Senator Bergman, were you suggesting that that date for repayment of 2011 was too soon, that maybe ought to be a couple of years later than that?
Well, that is a concern that I have about this, yes. I would prefer the language be such that the appropriation continues until the fund has an adequate amount of money to meet the appropriation.
Why are you suggesting language for the amendment to the amendment, Senator Berglund?
That's what I think would be appropriate.
Okay. Mr. Watson, do you want to state the language that Senator Berglund is suggesting?
You leave no later than June 30th, 2011, and insert when money is available.
Okay. Senator Berglund, I'm not sure if you heard Mr. Watson. Mr. Watson, can you repeat that?
Mr. Chairman, it would be on lines 21 and 22 to delete no later than June 30th, 2011 and insert when money is available.
I'll make that motion.
All right, we have Senator Berglund's motion in front of us. Senator Latz? Do you have any?
I support the amendment.
All right, we have Senator Berglund's motion. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Okay, then I'm not sure. I think Senator Foley moved the A38 amendment as amended. Is there further discussion on that amendment? If not, all those in favor signify. Mr. Watson?
Did you want to add anything to the Department of Human Services to the amendment?
Senator Berglund, did you wish to do that? Senator Berglund?
If they don't need somebody right away, then it seems that they could come and request the position and pay for out of this fund.
All right. We have the A38 amendment as amended in front of us. Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Further discussion or amendments on the bill? Okay.
Reason?
I'm not sure we have a motion.
He's going to redo it.
What is your motion?
I just heard Senator Berger enunciate which the council had
82 as a
whole. Pardon?
So it's not about 82 as a
whole. You're moving the bill?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Foley moves that Senate File 82 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? Is there further discussion on that motion? For the discussion, amendments, anything else?
No.
If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Any further discussion?
Can I see the division?
I'm getting totally confused now. Senator Dill asked for a division. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Okay. And opposed?